So welcome to the latest edition of The Green Room, where we digest the week in cannabis. I'm Martin Lane, the co-founder of Cannabis, and joining me is Cannabis editor at large and grumpy young man, Rhys Cohen. Rhys,
well known, grumpy old man.
Who's annoyed you this week?
Who hasn't annoyed me this week? Martin? No. It's been, so, you know, obviously the over-the-counter CBD changes came into effect a few days ago on February 1st. And, you know, naturally there was quite a bit of press coverage around that. Unfortunately, a lot of the, it seemed to me like a lot of the press coverage was just directly referencing press releases that had been issued by various companies in the sector. It didn't strike me that many of the journalists covering that event did much follow-up or, you know, sought additional sources for their story. And so as such, they ended up writing news articles that were basically just press releases. And of course, you know, press releases are designed to, you know, make companies look good or make the commercial opportunities look more real than they may otherwise have been. I think that the long and the short of it was, we had a whole bunch of news coverage saying CBD is now available over the counter. Especially if you looked at like the patient and the CBD forums on like Facebook and Reddit, everyone was going, oh, terrific. You know, it's now legal, this, that, and the other. And there was very little effort on behalf of companies involved in the sector, I felt, to moderate some of that enthusiasm, you know, and provide some more realistic expectations for patients. And, you know, as your piece very, very well detailed, you know, this resulted in a whole bunch of people turning up to pharmacies, turning up to doctors, expecting to have a certain product available, being confused and angry and disappointed when that wasn't the case. And this was all totally avoidable, you know? So yeah, that's who's been pissing it. That's who I've been angry at this week.
Yeah, and it's interesting because whether our anger should be directed at the journalists ourselves or elsewhere, I'm not sure. And funny enough, I swapped a couple of LinkedIn notes with Matt Cantello from ANTG on this very topic, because obviously I kind of, you know, having seen how newsrooms work over the years, have a bit of an insight. And yeah, absolutely. You know, we were, you know, I think on the back of your LinkedIn post, actually, you know, speaking to a whole bunch of doctors and pharmacists who were saying, you know, we've had all these people turn up, they're expecting that they either don't need to see their doctor anymore or that they can just buy CBD over the counter. And if you read the news coverage, you could fully understand why they would draw that conclusion. I think that the point I was making with Matt was, in reality, when the September interim decision was announced about downscheduling, it got a whole load of coverage. And the coverage was, hey, next year CBD is going to be available over the counter in pharmacies. Isn't it great news? Now, there were some sage voices in the industry trying to kind of stem the tide or manage expectations a little bit by going, you know, onto Channel 7 and elsewhere and trying to dampen down expectations and explaining the nuances of the, you know, ARTG and TGA and all of that stuff. But clearly that just doesn't cut through because the headline is, hey, CBD for all. And then what would happen, you know, from there was, I didn't see hardly any coverage of the final decision saying, hey, you know, the maximum dose is now 150 mil rather than 60, because that's not sexy. It's not a story. What I suspect, you know, really happened was the papers and the newsrooms would have put a note in their diary for February the 1st or maybe January the 29th or something saying CBD available over the counter this next week, and not thought about it again until February the 1st when a few press releases started to land, or they did a ring round and spoke to a few friendlies and kind of there's the story. So I thought, you know, I chatted to Teresa Nicoletti from AMCAR this week, and she made a very good point, which I totally agree with, is you can't really expect journalists, I don't think, to kind of understand or, you know, get into the nuances of TGA, ARTG, because today they're writing about cannabis, tomorrow they're writing about something else. They're not thinking about it all the time like we are. And I think it's on us as an industry to do a better job of communicating the story rather than expecting journalists to do anything other than go for the easy headline, because that's just the way it works. I mean, we can get pissed off about that, but I just think that's going to be the case.
Yeah, I think you're right. Like, you know, it's a fair point, right? Like, journalists write about a whole bunch of stuff. They get a press release from a company that they have no reason to assume is inaccurate or incomplete or misleading. They go ahead and regurgitate that press release in a news story and end up, causing a bit of a kerfuffle. Who's at fault there? There's obviously a bunch of reasons, right? So, sure, journalists shouldn't be expected to know ins and outs of every single story they ever write about. If you're writing about a story to do with a new category of drugs becoming available over the counter, and you're basing your whole story off one press release or two press releases from companies that clearly have a vested interest in making a big splash out of it, you wouldn't, I mean, I don't know what I would do in that situation. Journalists are under a lot of pressure at the moment. But they do manage to cover other, you know, journalism in Australia is generally quite good. You know, we're able to cover really complex medical regulation issues like COVID and vaccines, you know, and any number of things. It's not beyond journalists' capabilities to do more thorough work. I guess, you know, CBD becoming available over the counter isn't as important a story as, you know, the Pfizer vaccine getting approved in Australia, which is fair enough. So, you know, where you put your energies. And then, of course, you know, it would be great if, and it is incumbent upon industry to put out more balanced, reasonable press releases to ensure that the right information gets out there. But if, small change in the right direction that may make products available in 1 to 2 years, possibly, you know, is received in the same inbox as CBD available, get your CBD here at the pharmacy. You know, you can't expect journalists to run with the boring story rather than the sexy story. Right? I don't know if this situation's resolvable. You know?
Yeah, I was just going to say that, actually. I mean, to be fair, none of the press releases that I saw lacked, shall we say, an asterisk. You know, they all included somewhere the detail about, you know, ARTG and the likelihood of, you know, it being available and the time frames and all that stuff. You know, I didn't see any that just blatantly chose to ignore that. Some more prominent than others, absolutely. But
I saw some that did miss that, and all the ones that I saw that included it deliberately hit it, right? So, you know, it seems a bit, maybe I'm a bit cynical, but it might be deliberate.
And I would perhaps argue that it probably wouldn't matter anyway, because, you know, I've been there. Press release comes in, first thing a journalist does is go, where have they buried the real story? Because journalists are just a naturally cynical, horrible bunch of humans. It's true. It's absolutely true that a journalist, you know, yes, I know people just write through press releases when they're, you know, short of time or certain, you know, kind of outlets, that's all they do and that's all they want to do. But most journalists I know who are worth their salt get a press release and look for where the real story is, because it's not usually in the opening paragraph. So, you know, I kind of think regardless, it is a sexy headline. It is clickbait. You know, we can get annoyed about it, but I don't think, as you say, it's going to change. But I do think the industry has got some work to do in how we manage the media as a group. I'm not talking about individual companies, but as an industry, how do we want to have conversations with journalists where, you know, the argument is all good publicity, you know, all publicity is good publicity, but how can we get the coverage, but also make sure that we're not actually storing up problems for the future? Because the point that a lot of people made that I spoke to for the piece that I wrote was, this is a bad thing because it kind of raises expectations that we can't fulfill, potentially pushes people to the black market and makes us look unprofessional. So
that's kind of the cannabis industry all over, like worldwide, you know, like this whole industry has been run on the smell of an oily rag and a press release since day dot, you know. So, and it's a shame that the industry globally and in Australia, you know, continues to have this reputation for being blowhards who talk big but never deliver. And you know, this is just another example. But yeah, maybe when the industry matures more, I mean, like, oh, you know, I would love it if journalists in Australia knew, oh, you know, if I'm going to be writing a story about medicinal cannabis, I should reach out to, you know, AMCA or MCIA or cannabis, you know, somewhere, like, you know, that I think that would be nice to have that level of awareness, but you know, that'll take time, I suppose.
It will indeed. I think we're going to have to move on because there's so much happened this week, and I don't want to miss a thing. So, story that we posted this morning: the Narcotic Drugs Amendment Medicinal Cannabis Bill 2021 was introduced to Parliament on Wednesday. If passed, it will make a number of changes to Australia's commercial medicinal cannabis framework and reduce red tape. That's the kind of top line. Reese, what does it all mean?
Yeah, that's pretty much it. So, you know, this is so this bill was in the works for a while. There was talk that maybe it was going to happen before the end of last year, but it didn't get the time didn't work out. But this is basically just the next step in a long series of reform processes that have been going on for a number of years now. So, you know, the long and the short of it is the 2016 amendments to the Narcotic Drugs Act, which created the medicinal cannabis licensing and permit system in Australia, haven't been working very well for some time. That combined with the historical underfunding of the ODC has meant that the Australian industry was basically dead on the vine, you know, barring some notable exceptions. And it's really more difficult than it needs to be to run a cannabis company in Australia. So that's been acknowledged for quite a while. There was the Macmillan review of that framework, which tabled its report in 2019. And that Macmillan review is basically coming into fruition now. This is essentially implementing recommendations, or most of the recommendations from that review. So it's a complex situation. It's a complex framework. And we still don't know what the final version is going to look like. So we still need, you know, regulations and, you know, how to work in terms of processes and that kind of thing. But essentially, one of the things that the government is trying to do is reduce the bottleneck, which is the license application process. You know, let's set ourselves up so that we can better triage applicants. You know, you don't need to spend tons of time working on, you know, this very early stage. And have everything laid out in advance. You know, we can be more sensible and flexible in the approach. So it's a good thing. It's going to, hopefully simplify things, make it easier and quicker for companies to get licenses and permits, make it easier and quicker for the ODC to oversee the commercial framework. But, you know, this will take a while, right? So I think the regulations are meant to come into force within 6 months of the bill passing, and it hasn't even passed Parliament yet, still has to get voted on.
So I was going to ask you on that. But before I come to that, so just so I'm clear. So this is, there'll be one license, not three, effectively.
Yeah. So there will be a license which is a license, and then within that license, you will have permits that are specific to certain activities.
Right. Right.
So you know, you won't just be able to get a license and do anything and everything. There's still a lot more approvals and paperwork that would need to be put in place. But the advantage of doing it this way is you get to make those decisions about, you know, what you're making, who you're sending it to, where you're getting it from, like those kinds of supply chain decisions. You get to make those a lot further down the line, as opposed to up front, you know, hey, I'm a new company, I want to come into medicinal cannabis, I want to build a facility, and in 3 years' time, I will be receiving plant material from person X and supplying this amount of this product to person Y. You know, it's not a reasonable thing to expect companies to do, and it's not a useful thing to have planned out that far in advance. Usually,
And feels uncontentious. No reason to think it won't pass.
No, I don't think there's any reason it won't pass Parliament. I'm not sure. I'm not a lawyer, so I don't really know
what Reese Cohen does not give legal advice.
And I do not provide legal advice. And I don't really know. I don't really understand quite a lot of the language that's in this new amendment. It talks about creating or distinguishing between different types of drugs, medicinal cannabis drugs and narcotic drugs. I'm not quite sure what the implication is for that with regards to the cannabis industry and how it's going to operate. And there are a couple of other, it gets quite technical pretty quickly, basically. And you know, the legislation is great. And then, of course, you know, how it's implemented through regulation is another thing. And then how that functions in reality is another thing on top of that. So, yeah, we'll see how we go. But yeah, I'm looking forward to hearing from some of the more technically savvy and legally savvy folks in the sector and get their feelings on things.
I'm sure we'll be doing more on that in the days and weeks to come. Okay, so a couple of things to flag. Also this week, Canatrek announced it signed an exclusive supply deal for its CBD products and services with Chemist Warehouse, Australia's largest pharmacy chain, with the retailer receiving equity in the medicinal cannabis company. And the next day, I think, Jazz Pharmaceuticals moved to acquire GW Pharmaceuticals for a whopping $7.2 billion. Let's just say that again slowly, $7.2 billion.
This is now an ASMR podcast, everybody. We'll just be saying numbers really slowly into the microphone for now.
The UK-based company is the maker of Epidiolex. Am I saying that correctly? Epidiolex.
Well, most Australians say Epidiolex, but people say it in other ways, in other places.
$7.2 billion, I reckon you could say it any way you like, couldn't you, really? But it's for children with severe epilepsy, which was the first drug derived from the cannabis plant to be approved by the FDA in 2018. The thing I wanted to chat about is we got a note on this just sort of as more or less as soon as the story broke from Sean Hall, MedLab Clinical, and he was saying that kind of the high premium sort of really validates his company's kind of decision to invest in scientifically optimized, you know, cannabinoid formulations and go down the drug approval pathway rather than over-the-counter products. So I was just kind of thought it was quite an interesting kind of, you know, dichotomy, if you like. You've got, on the one hand, you've got Canatrek going down the OTC route, and then you've got, you know, Sean saying that this is, you know, a sign that they're on the right track. So what do we think? What's the, you know, are they just two different strategies, and both are, you know, equally valid, or is one likely to deliver more value to shareholders than another in the short term, do you think?
Well, like, without a doubt, getting a drug registered for a rare indication that has very few other treatments available to it, and getting that drug subsidized is obviously the most lucrative business strategy, but it's also a risk to reward, an investment to reward consideration, right? Because GW's been at this game for decades. They've put hundreds of millions of dollars into product R&D and, you know, for a long time generated basically, you know, no revenue. They've been doing the slow and steady long-term pharmaceutical route. What's really interesting to me is GW is basically the only company in the world that I'm aware of that is like doing this well with cannabis and cannabinoids. Like there are other, like, you know, mainstream drug companies, especially in the 90s, were playing around with synthetic cannabinoid, synthetic cannabinoids, and, you know, trying to push that through the drug registration pathway. They all failed. And we've got all these big, you know, cannabis companies with a capital C who are doing clinical research of some kind, you know, but really their business model relies on selling lots of unregistered medicines and recreational products to consumers and patients, you know. And then you've got all the smaller sort of biotechs like your MedLabs or your, you know, Botanics or, you know, whatever, like, you know, some of the other companies that are quite small, really, very small compared to larger pharmaceutical companies that are trying the plant-derived registered medicine route. But really, when you talk about, you know, successful, large, traditional pharma approach to medicinal cannabis and doing it well, it's just GW, you know, which is, yeah, always struck me as quite weird. But I also don't think it's necessarily, it's not really apples and oranges. Oh, sorry, it's not really apples and apples, is it? You know, comparing GW with MedLab with Canatrek. I mean, you know, first of all, Canatrek's one of many companies that say they are pursuing an S3 strategy. They don't have an S3 product yet. No one else does. So the extent to which they actually are pursuing that strategy is one thing, and the extent to which they'll be successful is another. We haven't seen anyone be successful in that space yet in Australia. I mean, they're probably all viable strategies, I reckon. But at the bottom line, if you're not putting sufficient money into rigorous placebo-controlled clinical trials, you can't really say you're pursuing a pharmaceutical cannabis strategy, in my opinion.
And just to go back, actually, it's interesting what you say about OTC. I think you've been one of the people on the record of saying it's 1 to 2 years. Chatting to Richard Di Natale this week, he was saying that, you know, in his kind of, you know, wearing his patient advisory council and healthcare practitioner council hat, we'll be talking to the TGA about kind of potentially streamlining the process for getting drugs registered. Is that viable, do you think? Is there an appetite within, not that you're the TGA, but do you think there's an appetite within the TGA to speed up the process to kind of, you know, fulfill some of this demand that's now been created?
I'm sure the TGA is very motivated to process applications as quickly and as efficiently as possible. And, you know, maybe if we're very lucky and we ask very nicely, you know, they'll move cannabis companies to the top of the queue. Although if I was another drug company waiting in line for my assessment, I'd be a bit annoyed about that. The real question isn't, you know, to my mind, and once again, I'm not necessarily a regulatory affairs expert, but from the conversations I've had with people, the assessment process, you know, oh, here's my documents, TGA, you know, please let me have my drug available on the market. You know, the assessment of those documents is something that the TGA to some extent has some control over how quickly they do it. But, you know, it's everything that leads up to that is out of their hands. You know, like, how long is it going to take any company to, develop a drug appropriately, have all of the manufacturing documentation available, have pharmacokinetic data, have safety data, put that drug in a clinical trial, prove that their drug is effective for treating a specific indication at 150 milligrams a day, prove that to an extent that the TGA is convinced that that is true. You know, like, that's the risky part, and that's the part that could take, you know, as long as it takes. You might very well get your act together, have a terrific product, and put it into a very large and expensive but short term clinical trial, looking at an indication that you think is most likely to be successful, and it could not be successful. And you could not get your drug registered. You know, that's just how it goes with clinical research. You know, there's a lot of optimism and talk around, whether or not the TGA would accept drugs that haven't been run through placebo-controlled clinical trials. I don't know how likely that kind of a variation from their normal practices would be. I guess, you know, if Di Natale's on the case, maybe he's got a chance. But then also, and to put my cynical hat on top of my cynical hat that I'm currently wearing all the time, is that what we want? Like, do we want drugs that haven't been proven to be effective to be available behind the counter in pharmacies? I think there's too much of that already. Like, you know, you go to your pharmacy, you got all this, you know, natural health product stuff, which is fine, don't get me wrong. But it hasn't been proven to be effective to the same extent as, you know, prescription medicine might be. I don't know. I think it'll all have to come out in the wash.
Yeah, look, to be fair to Richard, he was very, you know, clear on the point that, you know, the TGA's primary responsibility is to ensure patient safety, and as a regulator, that's what they should do. And also that, you know, those conversations haven't started yet because the council was only recently formulated, and they're still kind of, you know, reaching out to the TGA and formulating processes for those conversations. And the other thing is that Tommy Papert from Canatrex, you know, said to me, you know, the hard work starts here. And, you know, if I can use some horrible cliched marketing language for a minute, you know, kind of, you know, top of the funnel's full up now, or, you know, right, you know, fairly full. I think the trick is to make sure people don't spill out of the funnel, and we kind of, you know, over the next 12 to 18 months or however long it takes for them actually to be able to do anything down the bottom. So, as you say, I guess we'll have to wait and see. But either way, it just feels like a really big week in cannabis in Australia this week.
Brain's in a pause.
Yeah, it does. And just to finish off in terms of big weeks in cannabis, finally, a company backed by soccer superstar David Beckham, which uses compounds found in cannabis to make skincare and athletic products, plans to sell shares on the London Stock Exchange. I think it I think that happened, might have even happened by now. But anyway, Cellular Goods, which makes its products in labs rather than from plants, has sold a stake to DB Ventures, which is the former footballer's investment firm. So I went, with Golden Balls Goes Green with cannabis investment, something similar. You, that means nothing to you, does it?
I don't do sport.
Okay, David Beckham's a footballer. Have you heard of David Beckham?
I have heard of David Beckham.
And he's married to somebody called Victoria, who used to be in the Spice Girls. Have you heard of the Spice Girls?
Yes, I remember
Spice Girls. Okay, yeah. We're going more so. Yeah. Well, Victoria, allegedly, her pet name for David is Golden Balls.
Why?
I suspect because everything he touches turns to gold.
Or everything he touches, yeah. Anyway,
anyway, yeah, so that was my headline for what it was worth. But I'm interested to hear from you as to how you keep your skin so young and fresh.
So young and fresh? Is that what it is? Well, the trick I found, Martin, is to go very bald relatively quickly. And then sort of in response to that, just constantly keep your head shaved down to the scalp.
Okay. I didn't realize you were bald. I thought that was a fashion statement.
I'm going bald. I'm not quite sure how bald I am at the moment, for obvious reasons. And then that combined with my natural propensity to sweat means that I always have a lovely, healthy sheen on my scalp.
That's good.
Yeah, so can recommend.
Yeah, I have to say, I actually don't use any skincare products. But I'm only 32, so, I don't need...
You've got a remarkable head of hair.
Yes, thank you. It's all there, it's just the wrong colour. Okay. All right. Well, I think we should go and get some well-earned rest after this week, and let's chat again next week.
See you then.
All right. Cheers. See you soon. Bye.